see how far I get. We were hoping to look at cycle one. We'll probably be looking at chapter one. We'll leave chapter two for next week or the following, depending on what Pastor Matt decides to do next week. I'll be in Washington State, Lord willing. And then we'll go from there. But cycle one and cycle three have a heavier emphasis on judgment, and they look very parallel. They both have four sections within them that are similar. And we'll look at the first of those two sections in chapter one tonight. But there's a lawsuit, a covenant lawsuit, and then a lament. And then the final two are words of reproach and then words of hope. So in cycles one and three, the words of judgment are much longer and stronger and more severe than the words of hope might be encouraging. But then in that middle cycle, chapters 3 through 5, the tables are turned, and there's quite a bit more time spent on the hope, on the salvation. So as we look into Micah, a lot of these prophets we're seeing, they are repetitive. They do have similar messages. They're not that far apart from each other chronologically, so they're addressing similar sin problems. And these words of Micah, you may remember, they're during the time of kind of Assyrian domination of the northern kingdom. They begin before and last beyond the transition of Assyria conquering the northern kingdom. And the destruction is looming in the southern kingdom as well. Assyria even comes to the gates of Jerusalem. And they are thwarted there, but they've done quite a bit of destruction in the southern kingdom. And then eventually the Babylonians coming through and sweeping the southern kingdom themselves. So with that kind of all looming of the minor prophets, Micah is also emphasizing, particularly in that middle section, chapters 4 and 5, the hope of the Messiah more strongly than any prophet previous to him in the minor prophets that we've looked at. Of course, his contemporary is Isaiah, and there's a load of messianic content in Isaiah. So they kind of together are preaching this message of hope in the middle of the sin of the southern nation. And that's kind of it, is divine judgment followed by the messianic kingdom is the message of Micah. So here's our structure. I don't know that I mentioned last week or 2 weeks ago that with 2 weeks ago that with Micah, each of these three cycles begins with the call to hear. So that's in chapter 1, verse 2. Hear, all you peoples. In chapter 3, verse 1, hear now, O heads of Jacob. And then chapter 6, verse 1, hear now what the Lord says. That's one of the division markers in the book. So let's look at the lawsuit, which is verses 2 through 7, and then we'll walk through it a little bit more slowly. It says, hear, all you peoples, listen, O earth, and all that is in it. Let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, the Lord is coming out of his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will split like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. All this is for the transgression of Jacob, and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? Therefore, I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the field, places for planting a vineyard. I will pour down her stones into the valley, and I will uncover her foundations. All her carved images shall be beaten to pieces, and all her pay as a harlot shall be burned with the fire. All her idols I will lay desolate, for she gathered it from the pay of a harlot, and they shall return to the pay of a harlot. So this idea of a lawsuit here, we have... And lawsuit might be a little bit too modern of a term for the Hebrew mind, but certainly the idea of an official complaint or an accusation that's being made in court. And this is being aired. He's airing his grievance against the people of Israel concerning their breaking of the covenant. So the imagery here is pretty vivid. It's a lot like a few that we find throughout the Psalms. So the entire world is invited, in verse 2, to come into the courtroom. And they're invited to come and to hear the contention of God, even against them. So against Israel and Judah, but against the world as well. Because if the God of Jerusalem and the God of Samaria is going to judge kind of his own people for their sin, then surely he will judge the other nations that are characterized by the same sin that Judah and Israel have participated in. So the one that is nearer to him, he brings to judgment almost as an example to those who are further away from him. Now, when he calls for us to hear everyone to hear, he's not just saying listen, it's more than an invitation to listen. When the Hebrews are saying hear, and it is an imperative, it's calling for those within earshot to understand, to take the truth to heart, to actually direct their actions, their resulting actions, based on what they've just heard. So it's more than just, why don't you come and listen into our family meeting? He's actually calling for them to repent based on what they hear as well. So everyone join, because the Lord is coming as a witness. We see him later as a judge. He kind of takes a lot of positions in this courtroom. But first, he's a witness against them, the Lord from his holy temple. Oh, from his holy temple. It's like he's coming from a place of otherness. He's coming from his transcendence to be near to them in this courtroom. So, 3 and 4 describe that coming out of his place. His place that is dedicated toward his own work, his own worship. He's now moving from it to the courtroom against Israel. So the universal king, the divine warrior, is coming out of his house, down from the heavens, and his feet are going to touch down on the mountaintops, causing them to melt, causing the very earth to give way before him as he steps down. So that language of kind of stepping down or coming out of his throne is used a few other times. It's definitely all throughout the book of Isaiah, by way often of comfort, but also caused me to think of a few different psalms, 2 of my favorites, Psalm 18 and Psalm 46. So here are the similarities here in Psalm 18 and Psalm 46. I'll love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress, my deliverer. He goes on, I'll call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. Dropping down to verse 7. Then the Lord shook and trembled, because the psalmist's cry had come to God's ears. The foundations of the hills also quaked and were shaken, because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils and devouring fire from his mouth. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down, with darkness under his feet, and he rode upon a cherub and flew. He flew upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his secret place. His canopy around him was dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. From the brightness before him, his thick clouds passed with hailstones and coals of fire. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. He sent out his arrows and scattered the foe, lightnings in abundance, and he vanquished them. Then the channels of the sea were seen. The foundations of the world were uncovered at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. He sent from above. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too strong for me. And one other time, Psalm 46. So God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. Dropping down to verse 8, come behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. And skip the part, verse 6, which is key. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melts. It's like, this kind of language is used, and there are many other times that kind of language is used about God, and it's a good thing. It's an encouraging thing. It's actually a very warm thing for the people of God, because they had prayed, and here comes God out of his holy temple to deliver them, to make war on their enemies. So that's language that they know quite well, and again, is normally something that would provide comfort and solace, because their king is coming to deliver them, to give them salvation. So what's so different and what's so odd about this oracle is that he's coming against them. He's not coming for deliverance. It's not as though he's, you know, heard the distressed cries of his people and he comes to their aid as a delivering Savior. No, the cause of his approach is verse 5. All this is for the transgression of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. So both the north and the south. Now he says, what are the transgressions of Jacob? Or what is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? So there's the south, or there's the north. And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? So north and south, he identifies the primary place of their sin as the capital cities. The capital cities representing not only perhaps wealth and abundance and security, but also representing the leaders who stand in those cities, the leaders who stand in the gates, the seats of power. And so he's once again kind of targeting the corrupt leaders that are misguiding the entire land. But the question arose 2 weeks ago, if Jacob always referenced one or the other. And I think here's a good example. I didn't have a great answer then, but here's a good example, verse 5, of a time where it references probably all of Israel, north and south, in the first part of the verse. All this is for transgression of Jacob, all this for the sins of the house of Israel. Those two statements seem to be all-inclusive statements. And then he divides it in the second half. What are the transgressions of Jacob? Once again, using Jacob specifically for the north. And what are the high places of Judah? So I don't think the reference to Jacob is necessarily always north. It could be everyone. And on occasion, it may be the south as well. So these high places, this is the reason for God's approach. He's coming as a mighty warrior to destroy them, to destroy his people. He's going to ride the clouds, melt the mountains, and the valleys are going to split, wax before the fire, waters poured down a steep place. So there's just this pouring out destruction that's imaged here. Then God speaks to end the statement, to end the court scene, and he speaks in conclusion. He speaks in judge format. He actually brings the gavel down and states, here's what's going to happen. Here's what I'm going to do. I will make Samaria, the north, a heap of ruins in the field. And that happened. That is exactly what Samaria looks like today, is a heap of ruins. Places for planting a vineyard. I will pour down her stones into the valley. Samaria was on a hill, and so the destruction of the city, the raising of the city, and kind of the tearing down of the walls, you could just roll down the hill. And I will uncover her foundations. So down to the root, the city is completely razed. The capital city is razed. And then there's this removal of the idolatry from the land, too, identifying one of the key problems in their sin. All of her carved images shall be beaten to pieces. All of her pay as a harlot shall be burned with the fire. All of her idols I will lay desolate, for she gathered it from the pay of a harlot, and they shall return to the pay of a harlot. Now, what's all of that in verse 7 with the pay of a harlot? I believe what he's saying here is that there have been many pagan temple gifts that have been given toward harlotry, or for the purpose of harlotry. So those things, that wealth, those treasuries that have been collected, are going to be removed from them, taken from them, in the raising of the city. They're burned up. But who carries away the treasures? Well, Syria carries away the treasures. And what are they going to do with those treasures? Well, probably the same exact thing that Israel did. They're going to pay their own harlots. They're going to be taken to the temple, and they're going to worship to their gods, and that's done in very similar fashion to what Israel was disobeying with. So that I think that's it's going to be gathered and burned, and it will return to eventually do the exact same thing in Assyria that it did in Israel. So there's our first theme, is the coming of the complainer, the one who has an accusation to be made, the one who is the judge, and who declares what's going to happen as a result of Israel's sin, and the one who is the executioner, the one who actually brings the judgment itself. He's coming down to melt the mountains and split the valleys. So that whole scene is played out, and God's active in every way, accusing, judging, and executing, or anticipating execution. So then this second section is kind of what slowed down the process of studying in preparation for tonight, is that there's a funeral lament or a mourning song, a mourning poem in 8 through the end of the chapter. And it is, like, dense, literally. You'll see as we walk through, there are 12 names of cities from verse 10 down through verse 15. Gath, Beth Aphrah, Shaphir, Zanan, Beth Ezel, Meroth, Jerusalem, Lachish, Morasheth, Gath, Akzib, Maresha, and Adullam. There's 12 different names that are played out for us, each in a different poetic line. On both ends of the poem, and that's not represented here, on both ends of the poem, verses 8 and 9, and then verse 16, is this action of lament. So Micah's taking action based on what he just heard, right? Accuser, judger, executioner, what he said. Therefore, verse 8, Micah, I'm going to wail and howl. I'm moving to lament because of what's about to happen to my capital city, Jerusalem. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the jackals and a mourning like the ostriches. For her wounds are incurable, for it has come to Judah. For it has come to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. So, this wailing and howling is parallel with the wailing of jackals and howling of the ostriches. I think ostrich would probably be better translated owl. They use a lot of the same, or one word for, where we use a lot of different words for birds. So, ostriches, it could be. But it seems like with the hooting or the screeching of the owl that he describes, the mourning cry, the howl, is probably more like an owl than an ostrich. But I guess take your pick of birds. And then the wailing of the jackals. So just the cry of these wounded animals is the idea. Now, why is he going to do that? Well, because of what he's heard. And that means verses 6 through 7, judge scene, or the court scene, occurred previously to the northern kingdom's destruction, when that was first stated. Because the kingdom is still intact here. Right? We still have Samaria and Jerusalem intact in chapter 1. And I think there's a period of time that elapses between that and this statement here. Because verse 9 describes the fact that it has come to Judah. Now, what has come to Judah? The executioner has come to Judah. When did that happen? Well, after Assyria took the northern kingdom, the king of Assyria begins making this march on the southern kingdom as well, and he begins taking out various fortified cities. And in Isaiah, actually, chapters 36 and 37, I think, it describes this march against Jerusalem. And so there's a couple things that happen. They come to Jerusalem and they threaten, and you know, they say, there's no way that you would stand against us. And King Hezekiah is the king at the time, and he's consulting with Isaiah, and Isaiah assures him that God is going to deliver them. And so there's these threats and interactions between the king of Assyria, which is Sennacherib, and the king of Israel, which is of Judah, which is Hezekiah. And then what ended up happening is verse 36 of chapter 37 in Isaiah. It says, then the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses, all dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. Now it came to pass, this is exactly what Isaiah had said was going to happen, and now it came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that his sons, Adramelech and Sherezer, struck him down with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. Then Esarhaddon and his son reigned in his place. So he is thwarted at Jerusalem's gates, though he was victorious moving toward Jerusalem. So he's thwarted by the angel of the Lord at Jerusalem's gates, according to the word of the Lord. So this seems to be the time when Sennacherib is marching on Jerusalem. And he's moving closer and closer, and cities are falling, and fortified cities that are intended to defend Jerusalem are fleeing to Jerusalem, and they're not working, and here comes the king, here comes the king. It's like you can hear the beat of the drum moving closer. They're here, they're at the gate, they're at Jerusalem. That seems to be the moment here that that Micah is prophesying these things. And he's telling everyone, weep with me. She's done for. Jerusalem is falling. So, then there's this kind of lament for the people, lament for the cities that are falling, just the entire southern kingdom's collapse is brought to bear in this song. And it's part of the reason, one of the things that makes it difficult is that it's full of word plays and full of sound, puns and similarities of sound that just take, particularly for us, a long time to kind of work through and sort through. It would be very clear to anyone reading it. They're just like, you know, like we would hear a poem. But for us, it's hard. Lost in translation is at least as far as the impact of the poem. So we have to walk through a little bit more slowly. But we're going to do that in the last 20 minutes or so here. Just look at these 12 lines. And the song starts and ends with a historical allusion. So we'll begin with this first one. He says, tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. Does that sound familiar? Does that ring a bell to anyone as far as another time that those same words were said or sung? In 2 Samuel, so that's the difference between the first and second line. The first line, tell it not in Gath, weep not at all, is sort of this, like, stiff upper lip, don't let anyone see you're hurting, sort of a communication. And it comes from 2 Samuel 1. It's a line from a song of David. 2 Samuel 1 begins with Saul's death. So this messenger comes to David and tells him, you know, that he's taken Saul's life. And David ends up killing him. And verse 17, then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. And he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher. The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Don't let them know. Don't tell our enemies that the might, the glory of Israel, who was David's sworn enemy, right? But the anointed king has fallen, and his son has fallen. His whole house in that case has fallen. So it comes from a song of David that seems to have kind of been passed down intentionally, right? Teach everyone this song about King Saul. Teach everyone this song about Jonathan, his son. And my love for them, but don't tell the Philistines, because they will use it as a victory dance, and we don't want that, right? So what is he saying? As Assyria marches on Judah, don't tell Philistia. Not that they even have the same relationship in this day as they did in that day, but he's just saying don't show the enemies, because they'll use it as a song of victory when this is one of the lowest days of our life as a nation. That's kind of the intent of the first line. And it is contrary to every other line, save perhaps the last one, which is another historical allusion. So, tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. Don't let them know. Don't let the enemies know. Then he says, in Beth Aphra, roll yourself in the dust. Now, this is the beginning. You'll just kind of have to take my word for it as we go through. But Beth Aphra is, quite literally, the house of dust. So, in the house of dust, roll yourself in the dust. So, in this place, he just begins making all of these word plays. So, he's kind of, there's one translator or interpreter that wrote kind of a poem about it. I actually should probably grab it so I can just read it to you. But the line for this line is, grovel in the dust at Dust Town. Kind of like what he's trying to say, right? In Dust Town, in the house of dust, get on the ground. Roll around. Mourn. Then he says, passed by. So here's our word, right? Passed by in naked shame, you inhabitants of Shafir. Shafir is the word for beauty or a kind of comeliness, appearance. It's pleasant. So those who live in the beautiful place, you're going to be exposed. You're going to be led forth in naked shame. So he's talking about exile. He's talking about captivity, right? Sort of like a line of slaves in chains, marching out past the victorious conquerors. That's not a very beautiful picture. That's kind of the idea. So he's making word plays on all of these. The line for this in the... I'm actually going to grab that. He says, fair forth stripped, O fair town. He's like, you who are used, accustomed to such beauty, well, walk out in naked shame. I'm going to grab it so I can read the whole thing. The next line is, the inhabitants of Zaanan does not go out. So, you might be able to guess what Zaanan means. It's kind of a pun based on the sound. Zaanan means come out. So, the inhabitants of come out doesn't go out. Stir town, dare not stir. The moveabouts cannot move. Kind of the idea. Right? Those characterized by their activity are silent. They are immobile. And then we have Beth Ezel mourns. Its place to stand is taken away from you. So Beth Ezel is again house of protection. So if your house of protection is removed, then they are unable to continue protecting. So this is kind of like, you can imagine let's say this is one of the fortified cities. And one of the fortified cities is Beth Ezel, and they're mourning. Why? Because its ability to provide protection has been snatched from them. And so they weep because they're unable to do their function as well. For the inhabitants of Meroth, pines for good. You know the Hebrew word mara? Bitter. So we know that in Exodus with the water, and in Ruth with Naomi, she says, call me Mara. So as the inhabitants of bitterness are pining for, yearning for, desiring something good, something perhaps sweet, something that is upright, and they're just in this house of bitterness, then it's a word play of opposites in this case. The inhabitants of bitterness are sick for goodness and for relief and for sweetness, but they won't get it. Then disaster came down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. Now, what do we know about Jerusalem as far as its name is concerned? We just did this a little bit in the City of Peace. And what's happening to the City of Peace? Disaster, turmoil, destruction, war, right? Not peace. Disaster comes down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem, to the gate of peace. Sorry. Next one. O inhabitant of Lachish, harness the chariot to the swift steeds. She was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion. For the transgressions of Israel were found in you. Does Lachish ring a bell to anybody? It's in 2 Kings 12? No. It's like 1 Kings 12. That's not right either. 3 Kings 12. Hang on. Second Chronicles. So close. Second Chronicles 11. So Solomon is handed the kingdom to Jeroboam, to Rehoboam. Rehoboam has had this revolt against him. So chapter 11. Now when Rehoboam came to Jerusalem, he assembled from the house of Judah and Benjamin 180,000 chosen men who were warriors to fight against Israel, that he might restore the kingdom to Rehoboam. Drop down. They turn back from attacking Jeroboam. Verse 5. So Rehoboam dwelt in Jerusalem and built cities for defense in Judah. And he built Bethlehem, Etam, Tekoa, Bethzur, Soko, Adullam, Gath, Marisha, Zeph, Adoraim, Lachish, Azekah, Zorah, Aijalon, and Hebron, which are in Judah and Benjamin, fortified cities. And he fortified the strongholds and put captains in them and stores of food, oil, and wine. Also in every city he put shields and spears and made them very strong, having Judah and Benjamin on his side. So Lachish is one of the fortified cities that Rehoboam created. He made them stronger in order to be kind of the last line of defense for Jerusalem. So Lachish defends one vantage point against Jerusalem. And I don't recall off the top of my head, and I didn't write it down where, but there's other points that describe Lachish as a chariot, a city of chariots. In fact, I think it might be related to Sennacherib when he comes and attacks Lachish. I believe they flee from there. He says, I promise to give you so many horses and chariots that you could even provide men to ride on them. So this city of fortification is known as a military city. And that parenthesis is accusing Israel of the point at which they strayed. They began to trust other things besides the Lord their God. They trusted chariots. They trusted military might. That was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion. For the transgressions of Israel were found in Lachish. So he's saying, harness the chariot to the swift steeds. Go ahead and get ready all your battle armaments and take them as fast as you can to hide in Jerusalem. It's not going to work. Right? You don't have your military might, so the fortified city flees. So military strength. Line, I guess this would be 9. Therefore, you shall give presents to Moresheth Gath, Now, this is the place that Micah himself is from, Moresheth-Gath. And so he says, what does it mean? Therefore, you shall give presents to Moresheth-Gath. Moresheth, look here, means heir or inheritor. So the possession, possessor. So owned by, inherited by, possessed by Gath. Kind of the idea. Perhaps because Moresheth used to be a Philistine city. It is on the western side of Judah. So that's pretty likely, and the connection of Gath is likely. Could have been one of the tribute cities of Gath. So what he's saying is there's going to be an inheritor coming. I think I've gotten the wrong one. I think I'm reading Marisha. Okay, they are similar. Moresheth and Marisha. Okay, so Moresheth means possession, inheritance. So the possession of Gath, perhaps because it was ruled by them. So the sense now is that Judah will have to disinherit that which they have inherited. Okay, so therefore you shall give presents, right? You're giving away, essentially you're giving away the city. You're going to have to give away the city that you previously had gotten, the name that means I inherited this place. Now you have to disinherit it or dispossess it. It's kind of the idea. It is very similar to Marisha, but related to heir there instead. Okay, so the houses of Achzib, line 10, shall be a lie to the kings of Israel. Achzib means a deception or a lie. So this is one where perhaps our translations might be better done not transliterating and more giving the sense so that we could read it in its intended way. But the house of deception, or the houses, and this is Beit, it's plural. So I don't know why they didn't transliterate that, because it would be the best, the plural best. The houses of Achzib shall be a lie to the kings of Israel. So surprise, surprise, the house of lies is going to disappoint the kings of Israel. It's not going to be there for them when they need it to be there for them. Deception town will not bring you any good. They do nothing to help Israel stop the Assyrians. Then we come to Marisha. And there's kind of a pronoun shift here. You see now that it's God that's speaking. I will yet bring an heir to you. So that shifts as he concludes. I will bring an heir to you, all inhabitants of Marisha. And Marisha means heir or inheritor. So what there's going to be, this sounds kind of like a good line, like a line of promise, but it's not. An heir to the inhabitants of heirs. So I'm going to bring someone who's going to come take the city. I'm going to bring a destructor to come and snatch their inheritance. I'm going to bring a youngest son, parabolically, to come say, this is mine, and I'm taking it from you. Okay, so he's talking about Assyria, potentially, initially with Sennacherib, but then certainly Babylon. I will yet bring, so perhaps Assyria's already moved away now. He says, no, don't worry, I'm going to bring someone that's going to come and take the city. Oh, inhabitants of heirs. Then the final line, the glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. That might also be a familiar sound. Adullam, this is a rather historical reference, and it's in 1 Samuel 22. So after Jonathan has warned David, he has left. He goes and he takes the sword of Goliath and he eats the showbread. And then he runs to the caves of Adullam. This is one of the places that he kind of gathers his men together. So what was happening historically in that moment? Well, the future king, the king anointed, the one that's to be king, is having to run away and hide in a cave. There are other kind of cave incidents, right, where he's even being generous and kind and letting Saul go free. So that's sort of the king on the run
is the idea when you think of a doulam.
So what's going to happen here is we're going to have a doulam occur again. The glory of Israel will run to the caves. What's the glory of Israel? Well, Jerusalem, the rulers, the king, the priests, all these people who are walking the people away from God, they are its glory, its crown. They are her rulers. And so they are going to run to the caves in a similar way that David ran to the caves. So that's, it takes a long time to kind of walk through that. And again, it doesn't perhaps have quite the ring to it that it could in translation. Might be a good one to spend some more time on as far as thinking through the best way to communicate it so that all of us as readers can kind of grab the sense right at the beginning. But here's the poem. By a guy named Moffat. He says, "Weep tears at Tear Town, grovel in the dust at Dust Town. Fare forth stripped, O fair town, Stir Town dare not stir. Beth, Asel, and Merah hopes in vain, for doom descends from the eternal to the very gates of Jerusalem. To horse and drive away, O horse town. O source of Zion's sin, where the crimes of Israel center, O maiden Zion, you must part with Moresheth of Gath, and Israel's kings are ever balked at Balk Town. I will march the conqueror on you yet, O men of Marishah, and Israel's pomp shall perish utterly." And the conclusion, "Israel, shave your head and hair in mourning for your dear children. Shave it like a vulture's bare, for they are lost to you." It's not a paraphrase. It's not from his English translation by Moffat. So I don't know who this is. It's by an interpreter, though. I mean, it is his. This is the text. It's not paraphrasing. It's just communicating it in a way that seeks to replicate what the Hebrew would have heard when they're like, that's kind of what they're hearing. Is what we just heard. And of course, he ends by calling other people. Remember at the beginning, 8 and 9, it was his individual lament. "I will walk this way. I will wail and howl. I will go strip naked." And now he says to everyone, to all these cities he's just included in a poem of destruction, because the executioner is coming out of his place, marching on you. Yea, he's at the gate. "Make yourself bald, cut off your hair because of your precious children." So it's an A-B-A-B. Make yourself bald, cut off your hair because of your precious children. "Enlarge your boldness like an eagle." Here, again, the bird issue, probably a vulture, one of these ugly, bald, like I don't have any feathers on my head and neck sort of vultures. "Enlarge your baldness like an eagle, for they, your children, your precious children, shall go from you into captivity." Who are the precious children? Not just the little ones, but all of Israel. This is, again, to the leaders who are given account for these children of Israel. They're all about to be taken from you. You're not going to be a leader anymore. You're a leader of nobody because everyone has been taken. They're marched out, you know, so roll yourself in the dust. Pass by in naked shame, you beautiful people, the inhabitants of... It just goes on and on. So that's kind of the call, is these two portions in the first half of cycle one, the courtroom setting that makes the occasion for the lament song. Because God is coming as accuser, judge, and executioner by way of Assyria, and there they are at the gates. So this should be our response. We're completely undone. Everything we have is like a word play. It's done against us. The house of dust, roll in the dust. The house of beauty goes out in nakedness. Those who have inherited, disinherit. Those who have the city of peace is now in war. It's all undone. So I think two brief words of application. And then if you have any thoughts or questions, we can do that for a moment. From the first part, verse 2 particularly, the invitation of the world to hear these things, and this is a quote, it indicates that Micah's God is no provincial deity, but he's not a local God, just of his people, just of Israel, just of Judah. No, he can call the world to counsel. He is the universal overlord to whom all nations must render account. Again, it is ultimately, it's just that note at the beginning, but it is ultimately a call to everyone to observe what God does even with his own kids. If he treats his kids this way, surely he's going to treat the neighborhood kids this way. And then secondly, once Israel here has abandoned kind of the precepts of God and his covenant relationship with them, right? The knowledge of God that we saw in Hosea and Amos, once they've abandoned this knowledge and the covenant relationship, then they've lost everything. You take away that which is most precious and most foundational to these people. And they, while they've gone after other trinkets, they've gone after other lovers, they think it's a good choice, nothing's there. And that's kind of the point of the poem. So here's another quote for you. Losing the true good, in losing the true good, man lost all other good. And dwelling in the bitterness of sin and provocation, he dwelt indeed in bitterness of trouble. And the encouragement then would be to not lose the true good, to understand that which is most precious in the life of a believer, to walk in the grace that we have received, to understand the beauty of the gospel, to understand the fullness of Christ, and in him everything dwells. So don't turn from him to his grace, to other things. It's kind of a simple call, but we see, you know, as you examine, or you get to observe, perhaps even just the life of Christianity in general, that there are many that turn away, that walk away from grace to other things. And it's a simple call, faithfulness is, but it's not an easy one. So even in the moments of discouragement, depression, when it seems like it's not working, when it seems like another course might be better, stay the course. Walk in grace. Walk with Christ. And then you have Lewis, and in him we receive all things. Find the one true good, and you get all the other secondary goods in him. So that's the encouragement from chapter 1. Do you have any thoughts or questions before we close? Because these prophets are, their language is often very similar to apocalyptic language. So that's a good connection, I think an appropriate one. While there certainly were times, and you know, you think about Assyria, you think about Babylon, and what happened historically, that already fulfilled much of these words. There is, I believe, a fuller fulfillment on many of these words that are spoken in the end of times, in the apocalypse. So that's a good point. That ultimately is what God's going to do. He's going to come out of his holy place. He's going to touch the mountains, and they will melt. And he's going to say very similar things. So that's a good point. Yeah, it was very a sign of mourning. Yep. Who shaved their heads, sackcloth, ashes. Mourning.
Yeah, that kind of idea. There's one other line in here. So we just scratched the surface. Like this, I think, so it's 12 lines, and I think it is a chiasm. They're pairs, 1 and 12, 2 and 11. Like you see it with the first ones with the history of David, 1 and 12. And then each one past that, the pairs, use a similar literary device to make the word play. So, like, the depth of, or the intricacy, I think, of the poetry even goes far beyond, like, the initial, like, there's kind of what he's talking about, like, dust and dust. Like, he's using a lot of, and each one, like, some of them are rhymes. Some of them are actual, I don't even know if all of these are, all of them are actual places. If so, we don't know where they all are. Or if they're kind of obscure, the point's not the place, the point's the name of the place. So, like, if we kind of scoured Utah's map for, like, unusual names of places because we're trying to make a point that all of Utah is being destroyed, kind of a thing. But he said, oh no, it's in a different book. He used a couple examples of like Philadelphia. Yeah, being a place of like